Well, I'd first like to thank the organizers. This has been a really fun event, and a lot of great talks. Now, you've seen this before. But I feel that I'm justified in bringing it up again, in part because I'm going to frame my talk with not the discrete math day, but with the workshop on covering arrays, which is the second sort of half of these of this combined event. And we want people to come. So the idea of my talk is to convince you, no matter what your area of interest is, that it's relevant to covering arrays, and you should be interested and come. So I'm going to try and do my best to hit every possible area within discrete math, theoretical computer science, and combinatorics, and convince you that if you have any interest in that area, covering arrays are of interest to you. I hit some things which are slightly outside of that realm as well. And I'm going to come back at the end and tell you a little bit about five of these six talks. Well, six of these six talks. And I'll tell you in my talk when one of these is going to go in more detail in that area. And so you can see sort of if something piqued your interest, and I said, well, you know, that's what Rick Brewster is going to talk about. You say, oh, great, I'm going to come and see Rick Brewster in Ottawa on May 14th through 16th. And if I'm a student, there's funding available. So, the title of my talk is Covering Arrays. An exploration of diverse viewpoints on an applied problem. So let me first tell you what the applied problem is. Okay, so here's the applied problem. I have some system. You can think your favorite system. It could be a human body. It could be a computer. It could be a network. It could be some other kind of hardware. And it has some set of inputs or internal settings or states, let's say. And I can change the value of all of these things, and that's going to have some effect on the system. Now, I only want the grossest possible measurement over here on the end. All I want to know is whether I passed or failed with the inputs that I gave. And that might be something I can tell because I have the user's manual to the piece of hardware right there, and I can say, oh, you know, if I set Windows as operating system, it crashes. Okay, that's supposed to happen. Good. Okay. Or I may need an Oracle, right? Maybe I don't have that user's manual, and I'm going to gloss over this point by saying we have an Oracle that says, yes, it behaved properly, or no, it did not behave properly. So here's what we've got. We've got some set of inputs, some system, and at the end, I get pass or I get fail. And what I want to make sure is that the system is operating correctly. Indeed, if I get all passes, I'm pretty happy. Or if I get a failure, I want to be able to identify what was it over here that I did that was wrong, right? Was it the combination of Windows and turning the machine on that was the problem? I'm not sure. Okay, so let's talk about some solutions to this. Idea number one, and this is the sort of the most obvious idea. I'm going to try all possible combinations of those purple input parameters, every single possible one of them. Well, if the ith parameter has alpha I possible different states I could put it in, then the number of different number of different settings is the product of all of those alpha i's. That's an awful lot. I may not be able to actually do that in a reasonable time, which is not an excuse for Windows, right? That they don't have enough time to try it all, right? They can do things better. Okay? So this is really infeasible. I can't test everything. Okay, so what can I do in the event that I can't test everything? Well, I could do some kind of randomized testing. I could randomly set them, run it, see what happens. Reset one or two, run, see what happens, and keep going. Now, of course, what does random mean, and how am I actually achieving that randomness? And this is a sort of a constant problem when you bring up the word random. If I want to do this with any speed, I probably really need a pseudo-random number generator. And that could introduce a whole host of problems. In 1993, two papers were withdrawn from Nature magazine because they were in physics, because the simulations that they had done had relied on the best pseudo-random number generator available at that time, and it wasn't random enough. And so the results were skewed by inherent structure in the pseudo-random number generator. So that's a possible problem with randomness. When do I stop? When have I done enough? I'm not sure. That's another possible problem with randomness. And there's a possible inefficiency. There may be a certain likelihood that I'm going to repeat things that I've already done. And that may depend on how I choose. If I only switch a couple at a time and then rerun, it may be quite likely that I'm going to return to one that I've already had. So there's some repetition penalty, let's say. Now, I don't want to stand up here and tell you that randomized testing is bad, because I'm going to come back to it, and I'm going to at least try to tell you how you might avoid some of these problems. Namely, I don't know a lot about pseudo-random number generators, or at least how to make better ones, but I will tell you when to stop. And that's something we can actually answer. And repetition, there are some strategies that we can use to deal with that. Okay, so this is a possible solution to the fact that testing all combinations is just really infeasible. But there's a third possibility, and it's a kind of a uniformity constraint, but it's weaker than everything at least once, or everything exactly once. So I'm not going to do all combinations, but I'm going to ask that the combinations that I do have some kind of uniformity. So it's not random, but I know that it's somehow at least finding, you know, at least it's spreading out its testing over all possible combinations in some nice way. Some people may know this kind of thing as what's called not pseudo-random, but quasi-random. Quasi-random generators are generators which are highly non-random, but they spread out over a certain random probability space very nicely. And they're often used in things like Monte Carlo simulations or some numerical integration and things like that. And they can be provably as good as pseudo-random sometimes. So the benefits of this is hopefully I can have many, many, many fewer tests than all the combinations. And we're always going to know where to stop. And we have some guaranteed level of coverage. Now, what that guaranteed level is something we have to define, and it's something we'll have some choice on. And the object that answers that question, that does that job, is the covering array. So here's the definition. So a strength T covering array with alphabet size G, K parameters, right? Remember those parameters, the purple lines over on the left. There's K of them. They each have G settings. So this is a somewhat simplistic model. And size B, B is going to be the number of times I have to run that machine. Okay, what is it? It's a collection of B vectors in Z mod G to the K. I don't really use the algebraic structure. It's just a convenient set with G elements that we're all very familiar with. Okay, so I have B vectors, their length K, and they each entry is one of a G area alphabet. Okay, so all projections onto any t coordinates are surjective. Okay, so what does that mean? That says, suppose t was 3, and in that original example, which I can put up again, suppose these were all binary, on, off. If t was 3, what I ask of this covering array, of this set of vectors, is that if I look at any choice of 3 of these parameters, say the first two and the penultimate, I have tested all possible combinations there. Not all possible combinations over all of them, but all possible combinations of size 3. And not just that one, but also this one, these two and that, or these two in the middle. All possible choices. And how many are there? If it's binary and t is 3, there's 8. So certainly I'm going to need at least 8 vectors. I call those test cases, right? They're times I'm going to run the machine. If I need to have all 8, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, etc., I have to run at least 8 times. So that's a lower bound. G to the t is a lower bound on how big this covering array can be. Typically, I write the B as rows and the K as columns. And now I can't remember. Lucia, do you agree with me on that? Okay, so Lucia doesn't agree with me on that, but Peter? Yeah, okay. So I've kept half of the people happy. Lucia likes the transpose, K by B array. Doesn't really matter. I tried to get around the problem by saying vector instead of saying row, but okay. And of course, we want this to run in as small a time as possible. So for a choice of T and K and K and G, I want to minimize B, the fewest number of runs I need to do. There's an alternative way to look at this, which is useful from some points of view, and that is, given a T and a G and a B, what's the most parameters that I could possibly test? I know I can run it 200 times before I have to hand it over and put it into the marketplace. You know, what's the most, the biggest piece of software that I can test in that number of runs? Okay, so let me give you an example. And it's an example that we'll actually come back to. I've tried to choose all of my early examples as ones that we're going to revisit when we see some of the different points of view. Okay, so here is G equals 3, K equals 5, and T equals 2. And wouldn't you know, I think I've made Lucia happy this time. Yeah, so that's B by K. If you don't keep Lucia happy some of the time, you know, you get in trouble. Anyway, these are the 5 parameters. And I have how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 different vectors. And let's check that this is, in fact, a covering array of strength 2. So I'm going to take any pair, say the second and the fifth, and we've got to have every ordered pair from Z mod 3. So here's 0, 0. Here's 0, 1. Here's 0, 2. And 1, 0 is here. And 1, 1 is here and 1, 2. And 2, 0, 2, 1, and 2, 2. And if you check any possible pair of those rows, you'll find that it hits all 9 ordered pairs. Now, in fact, 9's that lower bound, right? G to the T. It can't be done on 9 with K equal 5. In fact, 11 is the best that it can be done. And I'm going to talk about how this was built, and a little bit about how we know that that is, in fact, the best possible. Although lower bounds in covering arrays tend to be much too weak than we actually believe the real lower bound to be. Okay, so that's an example. Okay, so now let me tell you about a different point of view. That's that array. I'm thinking of it as an array. I'm now going to tell you about T qualitative independent G partitions of a B set. Okay, let me put the picture back up. Put the picture here. Okay, so I'm switching my point of view. I'm thinking I have a set of 11 points, and each of these rows is a partition of those 11 points. So, and the partition is where the letters agree. So the first row gives me a partition that has 0, 1, and 6 in one part, and 2, 5, 8 and 9 in another part, and the remaining elements in the third part. So it's partitioned into three parts. Three because that's the alphabet size. I can go through all of this and write out what they all are. So my set B is an 11-element set. And here are my five partitions, each corresponding to a row. This one thing that this is really nice, and it shows us that if I permute the symbols within each row, I get the same partition. I really haven't changed anything. Okay, now what's the covering array restriction or requirement when I think of these as partitions? Well, what it is I take any two partitions, and I take any two parts, and they must have a non-trivial intersection, right? So remember, if I looked at row 1 and row 3, I had to see 1, 2 somewhere. These come from the letter 1. These come from the letter 2. The fact that I have to see a 1 and a 2 means that this set must have at least something in their intersection, and indeed they do. They have the point 9. That tells me where I would have found that 1, 2, and it would be in this, so the 1 and then the 2. So it's an exactly equivalent object, but for some of the work that's been done, it's a better point of view. A third equivalent object, which less attention has been paid to, but which is nonetheless very interesting, is zero error noisy channel communication codes, which are slightly different than standard error correcting codes. Suppose I have a channel and an alphabet to send through the channel, and I know that the alphabet can swap some pair of letters. So it could confuse 0 with 1 and 1 with 0, but I don't know which pair it might swap. Well, what's the maximum number of code words in Z mod G to the B such that any T set of words are distinguishable? And it turns out that, again, this is exactly the same thing I want that gives me the covering. It's the same definition. And so we can bring sort of Shannon's information theory into this via this model. And I will come back to some of the information theory that goes on here. So those are just three ways of looking at these things. Just let me give some quick, the first sort of published mathematical question or investigation that could be thought of as looking for a covering array was Euler in 1792, where he asked for his arrangement of 36 officers. And many people will cast that question as asking, does there exist a pair of orthogonal Latin squares of order 6? And there's a very strong relationship between orthogonal Latin squares were orthogonal arrays and covering arrays. And if he'd been able to find this thing, he would have had a covering array with G equals 6, K equals 4, strength 2, with 36 test cases. Turns out it's not possible. In fact, it takes 37. The next relevant sort of work was Sperner in 1928, and he asked what's the largest cardinality of a family of subsets of some B set. So notice I've got that B set. This is that the qualitative independence point of view operating here. So I want some subsets, K of them, of a B set with the property that there's never any inclusion between the two sets. And the proof of Sperner's theorem, I try and do quite quickly. So what we have to do, okay, this is just a slight recasting. I'm looking for the largest anti-chain of a post-set of subsets of a B-set. Anti-chain because no two are comparable. That would be a little mini-chain sitting inside there. Okay, so... well, how many chains of subsets of a B set are there? Well, every chain starts with the empty set, and at some point it gets to the whole set, and at each level I have to add an element, and I have a different chain for every different order of adding the elements there are. So I could say, I'm going to throw in 0 first, and then 2, and then 5, 1, 2, 5. So this would be 0, 2, 5, 1. That's permutation. So there are B factorial chains. Right? Every different order of the B elements gives me a different chain. And that's in this partially ordered set. Oh, by the way, this is for people who like partially ordered sets. If you like partially ordered sets, covering arrays are interesting, please come to the workshop. Okay, now, if I know a little bit more about a given chain, namely that it has a certain subset here, midway between, not exactly midway, but somewhere between the empty set and the full set, and that subset has size K, well, how many chains contain, what do I call it, a set A where the size of A is K? Well, that's easy. Before I get to A, that's K elements, I have any order of adding those K, and afterwards I have to throw in the remaining N minus K. So the answer is K factorial times N minus K factorial. So a total of N factorial chains, K factorial times N minus K factorial chains through any given fixed set that I want. Okay, so suppose I have I have F, my anti-chain, and MK equals the number of sets of size K in that anti-chain. Well, I can add up I've swapped over from B to N at some point, so all these N's should be B's. Okay, let me add up the number of chains through any element in my anti-chain. Right, there are M elements of size K, and for each one of those sets of size K, there are K factorial times N minus K factorial chains through them. because no two elements in F are comparable, they fit inside each other, all of these chains must be distinct. So I add them all up, and I certainly can't have more than the B factorial total number of chains that there were. Well, now I just do some simple stuff here. This pen is dying on me. I'll use a thicker pen, which means I have to rush the proof because I don't have much room. So, mk, k factorial, b minus k factorial over b factorial is less than or equal to 1. This is just a binomial coefficient, m sub k divided by b choose k is less than or equal to 1. And so here's my last line, gotta rush it. The sum of mk must be less than or equal to b choose k, which, by the way, b choose k is less than or equal to b choose floor of b over 2, right? That's the largest the binomial coefficient can get. Oh, well, and there it is, right? Because the sum of mk is certainly the number of sets in F. As I sum over all k, it can't be bigger than that. So that is Spurner's theorem. The largest an anti-chain can be is that. And indeed, Spurner showed that if you take all of the sets of the size of the ceiling, it is in fact one of these examples. So I can attain that bound. Okay, now, what does this have to do with covering arrays, right? B equals 5. So Spurner's theorem would say that those, well, 5 choose ceiling of 5 over 2, that's 5 over 3, that's 10, right? It's all the 3 sets. Okay, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to write the incidence vectors of all the 3 sets. Well, I'm not going to write them all, but there's some of them. Now, look. Pick any 2 rows, this row and this row. There's no inclusion between the sets designated by the ones. What does that mean? That means that there must be a 1 here that's in the same spot as a 0, because not all the ones in here are inside all the ones there. So I must have a 0, 1, and a 1, 0. I've chosen my sets to be slightly bigger than half, so they have to overlap, so there's a 1, 1. What am I missing? 0, 0. So you just add on a whole column of zeros, and boom, you have a covering array. So Spurner was really talking about covering arrays. What the Ulipoians call foreshadowing plagiarism, right? He took my idea 80 years ago. Can you believe it? Okay, so and there's another relationship with the Erdős-Kohl-Rödl theorem in extremal set theory, which comes in and tells you how to do certain things as well. But I want to talk about many different viewpoints, so I'm not going to sort of belabor the point. Just let me say that when G is not 2, and I'm not talking about subsets anymore, I'm talking about partitions, this is hard, but it can be used to determine some lower bounds. In particular, the best use of this to for a lower bound gives you that for a given B and a G, and this is strength 2, K can never be larger than this amount, where delta depends on the modulo class of B over G mod 3, or mod K, actually. G, mod G, pardon me. Okay, so that's the extremal set people satisfied, poset people satisfied, they're coming. Okay, now I've got to bring the design people to Ottawa as well, so let me talk about a little bit of design theory. Wilson's fundamental construction, of which there are many, despite the fact that it's singular, was essentially used to show the asymptotic existence of basically any design you could possibly want to look for. But notably, and the central variant of it, it talks about the construction of transversal designs. A transversal design is also equivalent to an orthogonal array, and an orthogonal array is equivalent to a covering array that never repeats any pairs. So a perfect covering array, as it were. One that hits that lower bound of G squared, where 2 is the strength. Okay, so I just want to show a variant of Wilson's construction that can be used and adapted to covering arrays. Okay, so G's 3, and I'm going to pick some design on 3 points. My 3 points are 0, 1, and 2, and my design will be the 3 pairs. Right? So design, because every pair appears in one of those subsets, in this case, exactly once, but all I really need is at least once. Then I take a covering array for each of those sets, using them as the letters. So here's a covering array with 4 rows, K is 4, using the symbols 0 and 1. There it is, and you can check that it is 1. That, in fact, comes from Sperner's lemma. You can do the same thing with the symbols 0 and 2, and the same thing with 1 and 2. And then all I do is I just pop those all together. Now, if I want zeros and ones, they appear here. If I want zeros and twos, they appear here. If I want ones and twos, they appear here. And notice I also have zero and zeros, in this case twice, but I pick up ones and ones here as well as here, twos and twos here as well as there. All of my x comma x pairs are also picked up here. So that tells me that if I want a strength 2 covering array with 4 parameters, alphabet size 3, well, it's certainly I don't have to do any worse than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times 3. 5 plus 5 plus 5 equals 15. But of course, I don't really need this column because it's just a repeat of that one. So I can at least get down to 14. Now, this kind of construction was one of the sort of the central chunks of my thesis. And what I spent most of my time on was trying to figure out how to make sure I can drop as many rows as possible, ones that I don't need. And that's fairly intricate, and it involves a lot of sort of design theory techniques. Okay, I've got information. No, I've got the extremal set theory, design theorists, poset theorists. Information. If information is your bag, then I'm going to convince you that covering arrays are interesting. Remember those codes. Those noisy channel error correcting codes. Okay. I've got a graph G. This also brings in graph theory for all the graph theory enthusiasts. Graph G on G vertices, little g, and A comma B is an edge of G. If in my noisy channel there's a non-zero probability that A and B could be non-distinguishable at the other end. If I have two vectors, x and y, on that G set, the vertices to the B, so vectors of length B, I call them incomparable on G if, for every edge that's in G, I have a pair of coordinates in both vectors that take on those two values. I just think I've got like a double negative somewhere in here. I think what I want is if A and B have a non-zero probability of being distinguishable, then I want to make sure that they appear somewhere, because that gives me some power to actually distinguish these two words. So I think I said indistinguishable or incomparable when I really meant the other. Okay, now let J of GB be the largest set of incomparable vectors. So that's the maximum code for this kind of noisy channel. Now, we want to know how big that code can be. And typically in information theory, we do things asymptotically, mostly because they're very hard to do in finite values. All of the really nice codes, with a few exceptions, are nowhere close to Shannon's channel bound. And that really reveals the difficulty sort of merging combinatorial coding theory with sort of information theory. They don't meet. So to try and get the best idea, we're going to do this sort of asymptotically. As my vectors get extremely large, that is, as the word length gets very big, I want to measure 1 over b times the log base 2 of that number of code words. Now, I've read the paper I'm about to describe many, many times, and information theory is still something which I find a little bit boggling, but I have verified all the details, and I understand some of the nature of the proof, but I find it a very tricky thing. Anyway, Gargano, Kerner, and Vaccaro showed that if my graph has a perfect matching, that is, if there's a perfect matching of letters which could be mistaken, then for sure the limit as b goes to infinity of 1 over b log 2, the number of code words, is equal to 2 over k. That's an exact value. In particular, if my graph is complete, that's that original coding assumption that I talked about, any pair might be indistinguishable at some point, but I don't know. So it's a complete graph, which, at least in the even case, certainly has a perfect matching. But even in the odd case, we can show this result to be true. And then my covering array is actually, well, the number of columns, the number of vectors, test cases, is the maximal code. So it tells me exactly what the size of a covering array is asymptotically. The limit as k goes to infinity, the number of parameters gets very large, of the optimal covering array divided by log k is equal to g2 plus little o of 1. Now, we cannot construct a single one of these, but we know that they're out there. And we're going to see that we can get a little bit quite close to this if we use randomized methods. And just to give you an example, suppose that my alphabet size were 2. There's my graph. I could possibly confuse the only two letters I have. Well, what does that theorem of theirs say? It says that the limit as k goes to infinity of CA, covering array, on binary with k inputs over log k is equal to g over 2, that's 1. Well, that says that the covering array size
is about log k. And that is about, when I invert this, so here I have a function of k. Sperner's construction gives that B, K is approximately, remember, B over B choose 2, B over B choose B over 2. That value for the covering ray meets this bound asymptotically. So Sperner's construction is asymptotically the best possible, and indeed it can be proven that it's the best possible for all values. Okay. A recursive construction that doesn't fit neatly into any area of combinatorics, so all of those people who I don't hit with a specific area, this should pique your interest. This was discovered by nearly anyone who has actually looked at covering arrays ever. Independently, many, many, many times, with slightly different variants, some small optimizations here and there of different kinds, which can all be combined to make something quite nice. And what it says is, if I want a covering array on K1 times K2 parameters of alphabet size G, for sure, I don't have to do any worse than the size of the covering array with K1 parameters in alphabet size G plus the size of the covering array on K2 parameters alphabet size G, minus some optimization that we can do. Often this is order G. Okay, and the proof of this is very, very simple. Here's the covering array, K1G. So, and there's my K1. And the size of this is, let's say, B1. Okay, so K1 parameters, if I choose any two of these rows, I get any possible alphabet pair, ordered pair that I want from the G area alphabet. Okay, I'm going to repeat this K2 times. Okay. Now, I've formed some kind of array that's no bigger, right? I haven't extended this way, but has a lot more rows. Now, is it possible that I already have a covering array? Well, let's think. If I accidentally picked my two rows to be in here, for sure I do, because in this block right here, I already have a covering array. And in fact, if I pick two rows inside any one of these blocks, I'm good. I have all ordered pairs I need. So what if I pick one here and one down here? Well, this guy is the same as that row because it's just a copy. So if I pick this guy and that guy, it's the same as picking this and this. And as long as those two are different, I'm fine. So what are the pairs of rows I could pick that would be really bad? I could pick, say, the first row and the first row again, because the copy of this guy up here is the one I already picked. It's not distinct. So I can get in trouble if I picked this row and that row. And that's the only way I can get in trouble. Okay, so here's what I do to fix this problem. Now, there are K2 first rows. So I take a covering array with K2 rows of alphabet size G, and row by row, I just put it here, the second row here, the third row, so on, all the way down. And I do the same kind of thing, sort of interleaved, with all of the second rows and all of the third rows. And since the only place that my original could get me in trouble is if I picked two first rows or two ith rows, this is guaranteed to fix it no matter what. And that's the proof. How many, what's the size of this thing? Well, I had B1 here. I have B2 there. B1 is the size of this covering array. B2 is the size of that covering array. Now, in these first two rows, wherever I have a 0 here, I have a 0 there, and a 1 here and a 1 there. So I've covered some of those pairs, and that's what allows me to get some optimization. I can usually chop part of this covering array off before I tack it on. So it's a very nice, very intuitive construction, and in fact, it's the best one we know overall, asymptotically, as constructions goes. But it doesn't come close to constructing that asymptotic known size that Gargano-Vaccaro and Kerner did. But this is covers of the covering areas we know, this is probably the best. Yeah. Well, I made Pete happy right at the beginning, and then with this construction and the asymptotic result, you can put them together and you can get another lower bound. And the lower bound is the following. Covering arrays can never be, they must be at least as big as that asymptotic result is, even when you consider it non-asymptotically. And the proof is very simple. Assume you could beat this, even by 1. Well, if you go back, and you start reapplying that construction, just again and again and again and again and again, with some optimizations over here, you have to use the optimizations. This starts to build up and get quite large. Large enough that asymptotically, you're actually strictly below what Kerner-Vaccaro and Gargano proved was the size. So it says that you can't have, even for finite small values, something which is below their asymptotic bound. So that's another lower bound. Okay, algebraic construction. I'm going to do this quite fast. And indeed, this is the covering array at the very, that we saw at the very beginning. I'll just get that slide out again. Okay. This algebraic construction has been developed primarily by Shatneff and Krayer, but also has been used by Colburn, a bunch of co-authors. And myself and Karen Marr, who's now at the University of Waterloo, were able to do some nice things with it. Just let me show you how it works. Take this right there and consider the permutation that fixes 0 and switches 1 and 2. Well, that gives you the second half here. So as long as I knew that I had 0 and 1 or 0 and 2 at every possible pairs of rows in this piece, since I just swap 1 and 2, the 0, 1 here becomes a 0, 2, and I pick that up. And as long as I also know that I had a 1 and 2 in both possible orders, no, I don't, yes, in every possible pair of rows, when I swap that over, I've got them as well. So if you have, this would be called a difference, be called a one rotational difference covering matrix. So if I can find some small matrix that has those very simple properties, essentially in any two rows, it contains at least one element from the pair orbits of this permutation group generated by this, which in this case is very small, but in some other permutations could be quite big, then I apply all my permutations in permutation group, stick the resulting covering arrays together, and in this case I need to stick a 0, 0, 0 column on because I only had one 0 per column before, and I'm done. Crayer and Chatniff were able to generate these matrices from one factorizations of graphs and get fantastically great results, really strong, hitting lower bounds, known lower bounds sometimes. What Karen and I did was say, it costs a lot of money to computationally search for a whole matrix. So what we did is search for the first row and then generate the rest by cyclic rotation, by circulation. So we only looked for a row vector that would have enough properties that when I formed the circulant matrix and then applied my permutation group, I would pick it all up. And Jason Lobb, Karen and I did it for all of these groups that we used, had one fixed point and then one n minus one cycle. And Jason has been looking at any possible permutation group of acting on any order of points. So he's generalized looking at the groups. So there's something for the algebraists. There's some finite field stuff, but Daniel's not in the room, right? So I can talk to him later about that, and he's coming anyway. And I'm running out of time, more importantly. I just want to talk about some probabilistic constructions. So back to the random number stuff. AETG Web is a product sold by Telcordia, which is the Baby Bells Research Lab in America, what they changed their name to. And their product, you type in number parameters and how many alphabet sizes on each parameter, and it will spit out a covering array for you of strength 2, but you can ask for strength 3 and 4, up to 4. Can't ask higher. What do they do? Well, they build it column by column. Take some first column, that covers some pairs. They take the next column as the column which covers the most uncovered pairs possible. They just build it. And they're able to show, using probabilistic kind of methods, that you can always stop before it gets bigger than this. So g to the t is that lower bound, right? We can never have something smaller than that because I have to have all g to the t t-wise combinations. And we do worse by that, worse than that by a factor of log of k choose t plus t log n, which, considering that most of the time we're concerned with t equals 2, 3, and 4, that t drops out, becomes a constant. This is actually very good. And their product is reasonably fast at generating these. But so, to come back to the probabilistic stuff I talked about earlier, we do know when we can stop. If all we want is a covering array, I only have to stop, I can stop at this point. I don't have to go any further if I'm using a greedy approach. Now, the greedy approach takes a little bit of time because you actually have to search for what the best new column to stick in is. And there's a random probabilistic answer to that, too. Godbull, Skipper, and Sunley showed by filling a fixed array, a given array randomly, just throw in the symbols, as long as you choose the size of the array to have the following number of columns, t minus 1 log k over log of this ratio, which really is slightly larger than 1, so this kind of goes away, times 1 plus little o of 1, you're guaranteed to get a covering array which has TY's coverage. And all they do is just fill it randomly. Now, this is slightly bigger than the last one, but it's much, much, much faster to produce. And in an industrial setting, time is often more important than being that much closer to the optimal possible thing. If you can generate these very quickly, you're good. Okay, I want to give something to the people who look at algorithms. I'm going to give you something else a little later. There's been a lot of meta-heuristic searches for these things, simulated annealing, taboo searches. Taboo is a technique to avoid those repetitions that we might get when we do randomized methods. Genetic algorithms, integer programming, a host of names who have done a lot of good stuff this way, Ostergaard, Nirmala, Applegate, Mallows, Stardom, Colburn, Gibbons, Cohen, Mora, and Zakawi, who will be speaking next, but not on this. She'll be speaking on something else, which I'll get to. I just want to briefly mention some generalizations of covering arrays. Suppose I had four inputs, but I knew that input A and C did not interact, so I don't need to test it. Can I do better than if I had to test it? And the answer is yes. The covering array, let's say binary covering array, for four input parameters, all of which could potentially interact, is the following. That comes from Sperner again, right? These are the incidence vectors of all three sets of a four set. Okay? So that's A, B, C, and D. But if I know that A and C don't ever interact, that is, I don't need to test 1 against 0 in A and C, I can do slightly better. I just make C a copy of A, and I can do it in 4 instead of 5. And this was the first part of Karen Marr's thesis work, and what we showed is that there's a graph homomorphism connection, which acts like a generalization of chromatic number of a graph. A covering array of size N, capital N, with a given graph defining the interactions in alphabet size G exists if and only if there's a graph homomorphism from this graph to a family of graphs which we specify in her thesis. And that's what a lot of her thesis work was, is working out what those graphs are, what their chromatic number is, what their max clique is, what their minimum distance, all sorts of things, diameter are. And there's lots more to be done on this family of graphs. And Karen's working on that right now with Chris Godsell, looking at using algebraic eigenvalued techniques and things like that. Very interesting stuff. And what are those generalizations of strongly regular graphs? That's it, association schemes. Because there's some really nice association schemes and algebraic combinatorics in these graphs. Quickly, it's unrealistic to think that every here I've switched back. These are now my parameters, the columns. It's unrealistic to think they all have the same alphabet size. So what if they have many different alphabet sizes? And Alan Williams, myself, and Lucia, and John Stardom worked on this a bit. And the construction that I want to just chat about briefly is, if we have a given covering array of a certain size, we were able to show that we can arbitrarily increase the size of the largest two alphabets. The covering array has to increase, but in a way that meets the lower bound, the minimum amount it could possibly have to increase. We also have a construction for adding on a new large alphabet. And that turns out to be enough to actually solve the heterogeneous alphabet size for a huge number of cases. Now, what Latifa Zakawi will be talking about is to combine the graph approach with the mixed alphabet sizes approach. So combine those two generalizations, which is really nice. I promised I would have something more for the computational people. The graph theoretic approach, that homomorphism stuff, allows you to prove that certain covering rate problems are NP complete, but the standard one is still not NP complete. It's only NP complete when we have a graph there. But if that graph is the complete graph, I need to test all pairs, we still don't know. So there's work out there for NP complete people. So just to quickly talk about some further generalizations, you could have forbidden pairs. I can never put Windows and turn the machine on. You know, I can never test that because I know it just leads to disaster. Okay? Say a test does fail. Well, how do I figure out which of those pairs it was? I don't know. Most companies already have existing test suites that they're fairly committed to and they've spent a lot of resources developing. Is there an optimal or minimal way to extend their test suite to a strength T covering array so you get all the benefits they've built in plus this uniform coverage property? And if we stop thinking about computers for a while and think of these tests that the hardware as some kind of physiology and say the parameters are drugs, we can't just give K drugs to someone and then K drugs to someone else. That might be too many. There might, you know, it could have a really detrimental effect. So if you want to limit the number of drugs you give to any one study subject, you have to start thinking about resolvability. And that is pairing up your test cases in such a way that they don't overlap too much. And so just to recap, just to come back to the advertising portion of my talk, right at the end, what I'm going to be talking about is those generalizations, the graph, the heterogeneous. Doug Stinson will be giving a tutorial on orthogonal arrays, which are these perfect covering arrays. Alan Hartman will be talking about the application of these to component testing. Peter Gibbons will be talking about metaheuristic searches. Charlie Colburn will be reviewing in more detail a lot of the kinds of covering array constructions, especially for higher strength, similar to what I talked about here. And Rick Brewster will be giving a tutorial on graph homomorphism theory with connections to covering arrays and designs. So whatever piqued your interest, we've got something for you. And that's all. Thanks.